Welcome to The Environment Show, exploring issues and events of the planet. I'm Thomas Lally. The Environment Show is a national production made possible by Hemmings Motor News, the monthly Bible of the old car hobby from Bennington, Vermont. 1-800-C-A-R-H-E-R-E. Your host is former Environmental Conservation Commissioner for the State of New York and former President of the National Audubon Society, Peter Burley.
Thanks, Thomas. Coming up on this week's Environment Show, we'll look at how businesses are beginning to worry about global warming. Some industries think they may lose billions if the climate continues to warm. We'll update a story we did in October. The Florida Everglades have been suffering an ecological collapse, due in part to water diversions and agricultural pollution. A new plan hopes to reverse that trend. Our ear to the ground Linda Anderson speaks with a couple from the Hoosier State who mobilized support for rare dunes there. And our Earth calendar celebrates the population boom of snow geese in Louisiana, which has been boosted by folks who eat crawfish. These stories and more coming up this week on The Environment Show. By nearly all accounts, the climate is getting warmer. It appears that our prolific use of oil, coal, gasoline, and other fossil fuels is the main culprit. What climate change will do is unclear. We suspect the cost to nature will be tremendous. But what will be the cost to our economy? Thomas Lally reports on how powerful industries are beginning to see threats to the environment as threats to their bottom line.
Ocean City, Maryland is quiet in the winter, but when the warm weather kicks in, hundreds of thousands of visitors crowd the beaches. A steady line of enormous high-rises stands only a few hundred feet from the water, and houses and businesses take up the rest of the space. If a hurricane were to hit here, or just about anywhere on the crowded Atlantic and Gulf coasts, the results would almost certainly be catastrophic. While storms have always been a threat to coastal property, many scientists today feel global warming might be behind the recent rise in both the amount and intensity of storms. The folks left to pay for much of the damage is the insurance industry. Gene LeCompte is the president of the Insurance Institute for Property Loss Reduction. He says many people are putting themselves at an unnecessary risk.
Today we have in excess of 50% of the population living within a 50-mile band of the Atlantic, Gulf, and Pacific coasts. In the first tier of counties, from Calais, Maine, which is at the northern tip of the North Atlantic coastline of the United States, to Brownsville, Texas, the southern tip, or all around Florida and the Gulf. In that first tier of counties, there's $3.15 trillion and more worth of insured structures. So we have living in and residing in structures which are right in harm's way, a big number of people.
The prospect of more and stronger storms has gotten leaders in the insurance industry worried, and some feel insurance companies are just the first to get involved. Eventually, other industries may find themselves in the discussion of how to curb climate change. Frank Nutter is the president of the Reinsurance Association of America. He says his industry is beginning to take notice.
The industry has begun to recognize that there appears to be a changing pattern of climatic activity that's affecting its financial position and has the potential to threaten the viability of some companies because of the insurance coverages that they have written in high-risk areas, particularly along the coastlines.
But insurance isn't the only industry at risk. Jeremy Leggett is the director of the Solar Energy Initiative for Greenpeace International. He says other industries will begin to feel the pain of climate change, too.
Now, the banks are threatened in two ways, really. Although the insurance industry is the first line of defense, if in that worst case there is a global insurance crash, a collapse of global property catastrophe reserves, the banks have very large quantities of money invested over long periods, both as debt and equity investments, in areas that will then be left without any insurance coverage at all, and you just have to look at the coastal USA to see that.
For many, Hurricane Andrew was the wake-up call. It caused over $16 billion in damage, essentially wiping out 20 years of premiums overnight. Joel Gordis heads the Global Climate Change Insurance Industry Task Force at Columbia University. He says while Andrew was bad, if a storm like it hits Miami, Philadelphia, New York, or any other populated area, the future of entire industries might be at risk.
Should there be, let's say, one or two catastrophic losses of the size of a Hurricane Andrew, but hitting in a far more populated area. For instance, if it were to hit, say, the New Jersey, New York, Connecticut area where you have very high-value structures in high density, it wouldn't just be a $16.5 billion loss as it was in Florida for Andrew. It would be in your $50 to $75 billion loss. If, by some chance, you were to get two of these types of events taking place in some sort of proximity, it would wipe out approximately two-thirds of the insurance company's total reserves up there somewhere around in the, let's say, $180 billion range. And you would have a real problem of trying to recover from that sort of economic attack on your economy.
While nearly all scientists agree that the climate is changing, there are still many outstanding questions, and industries like banks and insurance companies aren't likely to act without better proof. Dr. Kerry Emanuel is the director of the Center for Meteorology and Physical Oceanography at the Massachusetts Institute of Technology. He says while scientists have their suspicions about why the climate is changing, many aren't ready to make any conclusions.
Putting all this CO2 and methane and other substances in the atmosphere actually change things? And it is an important scientific question. I think there is no a priori metaphysical answer to it that says, oh, it's got to change things noticeably or it can't change things noticeably. But scientists usually don't accept philosophical standpoints except perhaps as a challenge, and we have to answer the scientific question. And I think we're in the process of doing that, but I don't think the answer is in yet.
But others say we can't wait for the science to confirm suspicions. Joel Gordis says the stakes are too high to risk not acting.
Even if there's only a 2% chance that climate change is related to storm intensity or storm frequency, because the amount of assets which are at risk is so enormous, it does warrant some consideration, discussion at least, and then looking at certain types of possible alternatives that cost nothing that could be implemented at this point before we actually know for sure whether it's happening.
Tackling climate change promises to be a monumental task. Gordis says it will take transforming our entire economic system from one powered by fossil fuels like oil and gas to one powered by renewable energy like solar and wind. Already, some insurance companies and banks in Europe and Asia are beginning to act on this issue. The time seems right. Last year was both the warmest year on record and the year when insurance companies saw their most catastrophic quarter ever. All this happened without a major event like Hurricane Andrew. If trends continue with temperatures rising and storms increasing in intensity and frequency, it might just be our economic well-being that motivates us to action. For the Environment Show, I'm Thomas Lally.
Anderson, and this is Ear to the Ground, with stories about people affecting change in the environment. This week, Charlotte and Herb Reed, married to the cause. In the northwest corner of Indiana, along the southern shores of Lake Michigan, lies the Indiana Dunes National Lakeshore.
established as a national park in 1966, it's located in an urban area, coexisting with steel power plants and refineries. It has taken a tremendous amount of energy and vigilance to ensure the preservation of what today encompasses over 15,000 acres of lakefront dunes.
There were various efforts and a number of organizations that were formed to try and preserve the area as a park or as a privately owned preserve. The efforts just before World War I were almost successful. But when World War I came along, attention was diverted to winning the war, and the efforts at that time faltered.
But never died. Herb Reed and his wife Charlotte have been active in protecting the dunes since 1952, the year they were married. Both had strong attachments to the dunes and eventually chose to raise their 5 children there. Together, they joined the newly formed Save the Dunes Council, whose mission was to protect the Indiana dunes by creating a national park. Herb says the first bill to establish a national Indiana Dunes lakeshore was introduced by Senator Paul Douglas of Illinois in 1958.
At that time, our opposition was several steel companies who wanted to build in the dunes area, plus virtually every politician in the state of Indiana. So we had a long haul and a long battle.
The Reeds and the council set about to convince the public that the botanically diverse sand dunes were worth saving. They did this, Herb says, by putting together photographs and a movie about the dunes.
We went around showing this movie to hundreds and hundreds of groups, everything from small women's sewing circles that met at somebody's house with 5 or 6 people, to large halls of large organizations where we would show the film.
Herb admits that he was naive back then and surprised by the outright lies that industry developers and politicians were telling the public.
We even had 2 governors of the state of Indiana, when asked why they did not support the efforts to save the Indiana dunes, said flatly that there were no dunes there.
Every spare moment, Herb says, is invested in saving the dunes. He says it's been bill after bill and struggle after struggle. Even after some 44 years, both the council and the Reeds are still going strong. Charlotte, now the council's assistant director, attributes their successes to their depth of commitment. She says environmental groups, which have disbanded once parks have been established, have a much harder time.
I think the need for a grassroots citizen organization that lobbies and cares for the park is absolutely essential for a park like this or similar parks to survive over the long term.
With Ear to the Ground, this is Linda Anderson.
We appreciate all the mail and the email you've been sending us, and we're always interested in what you have to say. So write us at 318 Central Avenue, Albany, New York, 12206. Or contact us by email at envshow@aol.com. That's envshow@aol.com. Or reach us on the World Wide Web at www.wamc.org/env. That's www.wamc.org/env. You can also hear the Environment Show anytime on the World Wide Web. Just go to our webpage, click on the Real Audio, and follow directions. Still ahead, we'll look at the recent plan to help clean up the Florida Everglades. And our Earth calendar celebrates the explosion of snow geese in Louisiana, which crawfish lovers have helped bring about. These stories still ahead on The Environment Show. In October, we told you about an alliance between some companies that use sugar, like candy and soft drink manufacturers, and environmentalists who seek to restore the Everglades in South Florida. Both want to reduce the subsidy that sets the price of sugar in the United States at a level about twice that of the world market. The companies want cheaper sugar so they can compete with foreign producers. The environmentalists want to reduce the flow of pollution into the Everglades, which runs off the sugar fields. This week, the Clinton administration announced a far-reaching plan to restore the Everglades. It leaves the sugar subsidy intact, but would tax Florida sugar at a penny a pound to help fund Everglade cleanup and restoration. Currently, the subsidy comes to 10 to 15 cents a pound. The plan calls for acquiring at least 100,000 acres in the Everglades agricultural area currently devoted to sugar production and farming. It also provides for the acceleration of restoration projects now underway, like filling in the Kissimmee River, which the Corps of Engineers turned into a big drainage ditch to the detriment of surrounding wetlands. Katie McGinty, chair of the Council of Environmental Quality in the White House, describes how the administration proposes to pay for the project, which will double federal funding for Everglades restoration to about $1.5 billion over the next 7 years.
We have to recognize Everglades restoration as a national priority. And indeed, there has been bipartisan support for trying to restore and repair the Everglades. I think that with some hard work, and the president is committed to that, his budget will outline a plan for restoring the Everglades that will dramatically increase the amount of financial resources we have going to this effort. With that kind of push, I think we can get there. Now, a point to be made here is that the president's budget, when he sends it up to Congress for the fiscal year 1997, which we will send to the Congress quite shortly, will include this major new initiative for the Everglades. What that says is that the president's balanced budget recognizes Everglades restoration as a priority.
Historically, Congress has favored sugar interests, but McGinty says they should approve the penny-a-pound tax on sugar intended to produce $35 million a year for land acquisition.
The sugar industry has benefited tremendously from the contributions of every taxpayer in this country. Through the federal sugar price support program, literally billions and billions and billions of dollars, taxpayer dollars, have gone into supporting the sugar industry. What the vice president and the president are calling for here is a mere fraction of that benefit the sugar industry has received from the public to go back into ensuring that South Florida will have an economically and environmentally sound future.
Everglades restoration is a huge undertaking because for 50 years, ditches and dikes have been built to divert water, provide flood protection and irrigation. And now many of those structures need to be removed to restore the sheet flow of water that is required to keep the Everglades healthy and supply drinking water for cities on the southeast coast of Florida. Tom Martin, who led the environmental coalition which has been pushing for Everglades restoration for some time, says the administration proposals are significant.
I think there are a couple of new important things in this initiative. First, the new 100,000 acres they've earmarked in the southern end of the Everglades agricultural area for water storage are vital to restoring the Everglades, restoring Florida Bay, but also to the drinking water security of all of those that live along the east coast of Florida. The second thing that's important is relief for Florida taxpayers.
In the coming budget battles, Martin sees bipartisan support for the Everglades program. In addition, others say that in this presidential year, Florida is a key state. With both Dole and Clinton advocating more appropriations for Everglades restoration, the money might actually be found. Nobody has tried to restore an ecosystem as big as the Everglades before, but it may be that the science and political will are converging to save one of America's greatest natural resources from the ecological destruction which we have brought about. And now for our Earth calendar, we proceed from one swamp to another. As we broadcast, the largest flock of snow geese seen in over a decade is congregating on the National Audubon Society's rainy sanctuary in the vast marshes on the Gulf Coast of Louisiana. The geese number between 250 and 300,000. Normally, they break up about now and head north for their breeding grounds, but cold temperatures are delaying their departure. One thing that's helping sustain their large populations is the increasing use of a two-crop system by Louisiana rice farmers. Instead of growing only rice as in the past, farmers are producing both rice and crawfish. This means they keep the fields flooded in the wintertime, creating about 300,000 acres of a new type of wetland along the coast. This is good for ducks and geese, has a huge impact on farm income, and is good for the land as well. In a world in which everything seems to be traded off against everything else, the rice-crawfish combination seems to be a win for everybody, including the snow geese. Lonnie Leger, Audubon's sanctuary manager, tells us how the program got started.
I started fooling with that in 1973. I put in a little four-acre rice field at my house and started playing with crawfish and rice as a form of an education. I wanted to see what would happen with it. And about the third year I was into it, I saw the potential of raising crawfish and rice together, because the crawfish don't damage the rice whatsoever as long as the rice is growing. And I had the area farmers looking. They'd come and check, and in my little pond at the house in my field, whenever it was time to harvest the crawfish, they'd take 10 little dip nets and put them in the water, and you was harvesting with the 10 nets about 7 pounds to the minute. And it was all prime crawfish, and I did some fast calculations on it that a person could harvest probably 2 to 3,000 pounds in an exceptional year. You could probably get 3,000 pounds of crawfish per year off of an acre of rice land. That's after the rice was harvested. And the rice farmers started looking at this, and they said, well, if it don't hurt that small piece, we need extra revenues to keep ourselves into farming, because the rice prices were about between $8 and $10 a barrel, and that's only in the neighborhood of $300 per acre that you was getting in total harvest. That was in gross income, whereas crawfish was selling at about between 75 cents and $1 a pound. So if you harvest in 1,500 to 2,000 pounds of crawfish per year, say it's $1,500 to $2,000 per acre instead of $300 per acre for rice, you can see where the farmer was going to try to raise his revenues as much as he could. And a lot of the farmers were in heavy debt. I know of farmers that was in hock, you know, 150,000 plus, and in a year's time, with just the crawfish, they paid off their debts and planted their crops on cash the next year.
Well, that sounds like a pretty good deal, and it also gives you more goose habitat as well.
Yes, it does.
So everybody wins.
Yes, sir. It's one of these win-win situations that I'm very proud of in my career with Audubon that I was able to be a part of.
That's super.
Because besides making better wetlands habitat for the whole wetland ecosystem type, crawfish is very sensitive to pesticides and herbicides, and especially the pesticides. And if you're going to raise crawfish, you have to stay away from the pesticides not to hurt your crawfish crop. So we eliminated some of the dangerous pesticides in this country, and we've cleaned up the water system and the land by eliminating these pesticides. and made a whole lot healthier environment for wild creatures and people combined.
And so while gluttony is said to be a sin, perhaps there should be a special dispensation for those who gorge themselves on Cajun crawfish. Because as stated by Lonnie Leger, whose family has worked the Louisiana marshes for three generations, you are contributing to a whole lot healthier environment for wild creatures and people combined. Thanks for being with us on this week's Environment Show. I'm Peter Burley. For a cassette copy of the program, call 1-800-747-7444 and ask for program number 321. The Environment Show is a presentation of National Productions, which is solely responsible for its content. Thomas Lally is the producer, and Dr. Alan Chartok is the executive producer. The Environment Show is made possible by Hemmings Motor News, the monthly Bible of the old car hobby, 1-800-CAR-HERE. So long, and join us next week for The Environment Show.